Hello, good morning and welcome. Yeah, it's Wednesday, the 6th of November, the United States presidential election looks to be heading in a direction that many in the business community predicted. We shall see, though, but we'll talk about that in just a moment with David Shapiro. Lots coming up today. We'll be finding out about two of the top performing shares of yesterday. And one of them has been the best performing share of the whole year. Got the CEO of that company on our program. Plus a lot more old friends, Peter Major, David Shapiro, and the water crisis, plus the problems that are going on at Eskom. Eskom wants to really crack the South African economy. Wayne Duvenage from Outer will be giving us insights on those. Big program coming up for you. Yeah, but so far, I suppose if you're in the Donald Trump camp, so good. Let's speak to our partners now at, or rather hear from our partners on the very latest on the US presidential election. Here they are with the news headlines from Bloomberg.
No surprises, no upsets so far in the race for the White House. The Electoral College score 198 to 109 in favor of Donald Trump. Looking at the swing states, Trump holds leads in North Carolina, Georgia, and Wisconsin, and now Pennsylvania. Harris has a lead in Michigan. It's too early for results in Arizona and Nevada just yet. Donald Trump has just won Montana and Utah. He also won Kansas. That's a total of 16 electoral votes. Harris has won Colorado, which is 10 electoral votes. Looking at the congressional makeup right now in the Senate, Republicans lead Democrats 47 to 36. In the House, Republicans lead 114 to 80. The latest NBC News exit poll of the night shows that suburban white women are supporting Donald Trump this year, with about 51% picking him. Still, he sees a 5% point drop among this bloc compared with 2020. And looking at Pennsylvania, Trump is picking up more Latino votes than in 2020. That's according to the NBC News exit poll. Let's look at how the election results are affecting markets so far with Bloomberg's Doug Krisner.
We had a rally in the U.S. equity market during the regular session with the S&P up about 1.6%. And as these election results begin to come in, we're seeing kind of a mixed picture right now for markets in Asia. The Nikkei, for example, given some yen weakness, is up about 1.5%. Different story, though, in Hong Kong, where the Hang Seng is down about 0.9%. And on the Chinese mainland, the CSI 300 is up about 0.9%.
All right. Thank you, Doug. That's Bloomberg's Doug Krisner. And Bitcoin has risen to a record high as traders continue to watch the election results coming in. Republican Ted Cruz has won re-election in the Texas Senate race, defeating Democrat Colin Allred. Let's turn now to Bloomberg's Anne-Marie Hordern.
This was the white whale moment, potentially, for the Democrats, the one place they were playing aggressive offense. But everyone thought it potentially could be a pipe dream. It ended up being a pipe dream. Senator Ted Cruz holds a seat.
And that's a big one in Texas, a very, very big one indeed. And the reason for that is that if you don't have the fat lady, as they call it in the United States, well, it's not an easy one to win. But let's have a look at the overnight issues from the markets in the United States. The S&P 500 index was up by 1.25%. Remember, this is way before the electoral news came through that Donald Trump does appear to be in front. Just to unpack that for you very quickly, there are no surprises so far, which means that what the pundits are suggesting is going to go Trump's way and is going to go Harris's way are exactly as predicted. That means that there are seven swing states or toss-up states. North Carolina, Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona, and Nevada. Arizona and Nevada, neither of those do we have any insight yet on the results. But the exit polls, in other words, when people come out of voting, they get interviewed by various experts. Those exit polls are showing that Trump is ahead in four of those states, which would take him, with all other things being equal, to 281 Electoral College votes. And he needs 270 to become the president. So it's far too early to call a victory. Harris, by the way, is ahead in Michigan only. So it's far too early to call a victory. But these moves last night on the American stock market did give a little bit of a Trump trade bump. Our portfolio shot the lights out. Palantir was up by 23.5% after financial results were released following the market close. Palantir is the market close on, when was that? Anyway, the day before. So yesterday, Tuesday, the Palantir stock price was up 23.5% after results came out on Monday night. That is the biggest share in the Shift portfolio and one of the biggest in the WebTrader portfolio. And it's heading now for a 10-bagger for BizNews Tribe members who've invested alongside us. Tesla up 3.5%, NVIDIA 2.8%, Amazon nearly 2%, and the Russell 2000 ETF was nearly 2% higher. S&P 500 index was 1.25% stronger, NASDAQ 1.5%. Bitcoin is on a, it's going gangbusters, up 9% last night. In here in South Africa, again, it was a positive day, but the rand fell 24 cents against the US dollar. That is because of dollar strength, nothing to do with the South African rand, and against the pound, 14 cents lower at 22.89 to the pound, 17.76 to the rand. The major indices on the South African market up by between 0.25% and 1.25%. Of the stocks that we keep a close eye on, the top stocks in South Africa, Sibanye 10% higher, Altron 5.5% stronger, and we will be getting it more in detail on both of those stocks today. Best performance on the JSE yesterday. And then amongst the resources, Impala Platinum and Anglo Platinum, 3% better on the way down. ArcelorMittal still struggling. Woolworths, 2.6% weaker. Well, before we leave the US elections and bring in David Shapiro for a conversation on what he's seeing about things, here's our partners at Bloomberg looking at the implications of what could happen if Donald Trump were to win, or indeed if Harris were to win. This time they're focusing, or the correspondent is focusing on California. Ruan will play that clip for us now.
Across the country on this route after having done it during the lead up to the 2020 election too. When I arrived in downtown San Francisco back then in 2020, I witnessed something I never expected to see in my lifetime. Contractors sawing plywood and boarding up storefront windows in preparation for possible post-election violence. Business owners feared that if Donald Trump won, there could be riots in the streets. As things turned out, of course, it was people on the other side who resorted to violence on January 6th at the Capitol. This time, the question looming over the election is, will the losing side accept defeat? As it happens, the importance of that question lies at the heart of a small town along the Lincoln Highway in Austin, Nevada. Last week, we stopped there to see an old general store that still stands on the Lincoln Highway. In 1864, its owner, Ruel Gridley, who was a Democrat, made a bet with a Republican on the local mayor's race. As the story goes, whoever lost the bet would have to march through town carrying a sack of flour. When Gridley lost the bet, he was as good as his word, and he even agreed to auction off the sack of flour to benefit wounded Union soldiers, even though he had Southern sympathies. As news of the auction spread, helped by a young reporter in Nevada named Samuel Clemens, Gridley agreed to take the sack of flour on a tour of the U.S., holding auctions everywhere he went and raising more than $250,000 for wounded Union soldiers. Gridley played an essential role in democracy. The gracious loser who accepts defeat for the good of the country. In 1887, Union Army veterans erected a monument on Gridley's gravesite in another Lincoln Highway town, Stockton, California. But his fame and the essential lesson he taught has long faded from American memory. It's a story that we need to recapture because we all have a civic duty to carry the sack of flour. So as I've been traveling the Lincoln Highway, I've been sharing Gridley's story and even giving out campaign buttons with a sack of flour on them. The response has been universally positive, and I was especially heartened by a kindergarten teacher I met in Denver who told me that she was going to incorporate the story of Gridley into a pre-election day lesson. It's a lesson for all ages and all eras. With the exception of the Civil War era, carrying the sack of flour has never been a partisan idea, and we can't let it become one again. I call it flower power, and the fate of our democracy hinges on our belief in it today and every election day.
What a lovely story, Mr. Grindley, and the contribution he's made to American democracy. Well, David Shapiro has got a lot of views, a lot of thoughts, a lot of suggestions about what is going on in the United States. And he joins us now, not least because you have family over there, David, for those who don't know.
I do. They voted. You know what's interesting about that Grindley story is that he was a Democrat, which was the side that backed the South. Remember that Lincoln was a Republican. So things have switched. And you know what's interesting about that and what's wonderful about that story is that if we look at the number of votes, Harris might even get the popular vote. And yet, I think the hope is that, you know, if Trump does win, that he recognizes that, you know, as many people voted for her as for him, and that he runs the country, you know, understanding that, that he didn't, it wasn't a landslide in terms of that. And that's always a concern with me, is that, you know, the winning party just tends to kind of run almost wild over the opposition and the celebrations and so on. I'm watching through my, just over my shoulder now as results come through. You know, they have, Republicans have taken North Carolina, and as you said in the introduction, it's still those other swing states that are on a knife edge, literally. You know, every vote is now counting. But I tend to agree with you. My heart is with Harris, but my head says that Trump's just going to edge her out. And that's why the markets are doing what they're doing, Alec.
Why do they like Trump so much?
I don't know. I can't understand it, you know, because he has a man whose financial affairs are an absolute shambles. You know, his accountant is in jail, or if not in jail, has been sentenced to jail, serving there. You know, he's a man who's been convicted of not rape, but abuse to women. There's so many things against him, and yet that doesn't count. And, you know, even from a religious point of view, and I don't want to bring religion in, but you would think that very religious people would follow maybe what the Old or New Testament say about, you know, particularly the Ten Commandments. He's abused every one of them, and it doesn't matter. And, you know, they change the conversation, you know, accordingly. Oh, well, as long as he's a good governor, it doesn't matter that he's a bad man. He's good for the country, you know. So you always find that you can manipulate the story. But I think markets are, you know, they see the rand. I saw in your introduction slide, you know, 76. It's around about 1770 at the moment. And that's, as you say, that's dollar strength. Worries about inflation. You know, worries that Trump's policies are going to be inflationary. And that's why you've watched the 10-year treasury. Bonds are going up. Alec, when you look at that, and I must mention it, the 10-year there is now almost 4.5. I think it's just below that. A few months ago, that was 3.6 when Powell started to reduce interest rates. You know, and we were now on this trajectory downwards with rates coming down. So that swung around. I mean, for bondholders, that's been chaotic. But the equity market on the other side is just roaring.
Gangbusters. Here in South Africa, David, we had a trading statement from Marian Roberts yesterday afternoon. I had a look at it. Let's get your thoughts. It seems to me almost a bit like a accountants are managing this company. I won't say into the graveyard, but jeepers creepers. It's a little bit like EOH. Here was a big company. Instead of growing revenues, they're saying, "Well, we got to cut costs." And it's a shadow already of what it was.
It's been a disaster. This was a massive business in the construction side. You know, we all remember, what's his name? Bruce. I can't
Brian remember Bruce.
He was Brian Bruce, yeah, running it.
Dave Brink before
so
him.
Many
yeah.
Arms, yeah. You know, and what happened now in the latest story is that this is Venetia Gold, Diamond Mine, which is cutting back because, you know, the diamond market has collapsed. So they had a contract there. They had a mining contract there, which has now been put on hold. They used a word that I've never seen in the English dictionary, and I'd have to look it up to explain what it said. I'm trying to look for it. I'd written it down. But, you know, they've lost that contract, which is very important for them because they have gone the mining route. You know, they don't call themselves a construction company anymore. But I think over the last decade or so, this is a company that's just been dragged down by very, very poor performances in the areas in which they've been operating, you know, whether it's been in the Middle East, whether it's been in Australia, wherever it's been. It's got a market cap of one billion rand, which is nothing. I mean, that is an ultra small cap. So it's tragic to see what's happened to our construction. Alec, we discussed it the other day with PP Cement and with Sephaku. You know, there is no construction in South Africa. And that's why these businesses are battling, and they're battling to hold on to their skills, because you can't let them go, and then you get a contract and you've got to go hunt for skills. So it really reflects what's happened to the South African economy, you know, our construction companies and those companies right at the bottom of the, that provide the services and provide all the equipment for expansion.
Marion Roberts, wow. Who would have thought? And they had big international interests, Clough in Australia. That was the downfall to a degree of Wilson Bailey. They managed to extricate themselves and they seem to be doing things better again, but stayed in construction. Marion Roberts taking a different view. David, what about Altron? You and I know the late Robbie Fenter well. We both knew Bill Fenter, who's still living in Monaco and knocking around. I saw pictures. Robbie used to send me pictures of him and Bill having, you know, seeing each other. They saw a lot of each other. And Altron is just shooting the lights out. It's more than doubled the share price this year, the top performing stock on the JSE. Who would have thought?
It came under a lot of pressure. Remember when they unbundled Bytes? You know, Bytes also had its problems in the UK. It's still a very good business. But they put their head down and their divisions are all doing well. You know, there are a whole lot of divisions that they're, you know, whether it's fintech, whether it's health tech. In other words, providing, call it, what's it?
Well, new age.
Software or
New age type
services to these businesses. Yeah. You know, software, if you're going to a hospital now, all the equipment and all the patient records are run by these kind of companies. And they're doing well. And as you said, they've almost doubled now. So I think, you know, we've still got those businesses here that can turn around and do well, even in a very difficult and challenging environment. But I have to congratulate you on Palantir. I mean, brilliant choice. You know, you had the courage to go out and follow this. And this is at the forefront of AI and just benefiting. Wonderful choice, Bill.
Well, the reason for Palantir is something that is going to shock many of the BizNews tribe who think that the World Economic Forum is a dreadful place and it's a globalist and they're doing horrible things. Well, if you've bought Palantir, thank the WEF, because I was at the World Economic Forum, was it 2 years ago, where I met Alex Karp. The share price was $8. And this guy impressed the heck out of me, David. When I then started reading through the information that Palantir was doing, what they were up to, the fact that they'd spent years building five products that were ready for the new artificial intelligence age, but no one had kind of got it yet. And that's the consequence of those products now really, really hitting their straps. It's a bit like you and ASML. When you found ASML, I remember talking to you about that and thinking, oh, come on, Dave, you know, really, this Dutch company, ex-Philips, what the heck are you talking about? But you'd done your homework and you shared that with anybody who'd been prepared to listen. And had we all followed you back then, well, it must be a 10-bagger by now since you invested there.
Well, it's up in the 300-400%. Yeah, it's had a little bit of a rough year, but I think that's just temporary. I'm not they still got the technology, and they lead in technology. Palantir, that's where they're leading. They're teaching companies how to use AI and how to use all the data that they accumulate. You know, it's useless if you don't know how to use it, and that's their skill. And small business, but you're right to watch it. There's certain companies that will lead the way, you know, through this. And the AI is only in its infancy. So these are the kind of businesses. Well done.
David, I'm going to ask Ruan to actually change the running order a little bit, because we had Werner Kapp from Altron at the end of the show. I want you to watch this. And before we watch it, because I asked him about the amazing performance of the share price this year, where the price has doubled. In fact, it's a two-horse race. If you look at the JSE year to date, it's between Altron and WeBuyCars. WeBuyCars nearly 100%, 98% up from their listing price, and Altron more than 100%, including that big jump yesterday. But something to put in the back of your mind. Altron owns Netstar. Altron's total value is 8 billion rand. Netstar competes with Cartrack. So Netstar is about 20% of Altron, okay? Cartrack is listed separately on the New York Stock Exchange, or sorry, on NASDAQ in America, and it's worth $2 billion. So we're talking about a $34 billion business. Sorry, 34 billion rand business, because the Americans appreciate Cartrack, as against an 8 billion rand business because the South Africans don't appreciate Netstar. There's a story here for us to, it's an ASML and perhaps a Palantir story for us to really take note of and do our own homework. But Ruan, perhaps you can just play the clip of the interview that I had yesterday with Werner Kapp, the CEO of Altron, where I asked
him. When I arrived at Altron about 2 years ago, what I found was a business that I felt was underappreciated. I felt that we had great solutions that really solve real-world problems for our customers and for the country. A blue-chip customer list, sort of great people. And at the time, I said, folks, I feel that we're the best-kept secret in the market. Why didn't I know all of that before I worked for Altron? So I think a part of it is telling that story better to our customers. Obviously, we've been executing in a fairly disciplined manner, I'd like to think, over the last 18 months. On this strategy to be the leading platform and IT services company. I'm delighted that the market is rewarding that performance.
It's still very cheap, though, if you take a line through Karoo, which owns Cartrack, because you own Netstar. Now, Cartrack's pretty much their business. Netstar is one of your businesses. And Karoo is listed in America. Its market value is $2 billion, give or take 30. What's that about? Well, 30 billion rand at least. Your market value is only 8.5 billion rand. So when you look at, you compare the two, but what am I missing here? What's the difference? Is Netstar really that much smaller than Cartrack?
I think it's a good question. I mean, as you know, always difficult for a kind of CEO to comment on market capitalization or how the market values your business. Karoo, obviously Cartrack, very good company. We compete with them in the same market. I think, but maybe part of the challenge has been historically, you talk about the market starting to appreciate the Altron business more. I speak about it not being the best kept secret anymore. That's why we've, been quite distinct about talking about the platform side of our business and talking about the IT services part of our business. So, maybe it's an understanding issue. But it's really nice to see that the market is starting to appreciate that more.
Okay, Dave. Well, let's take away, Ruan, if you could drop the rest of that clip and just get David's thoughts on that. I remember Pitt telling us at one of the conferences, Pitt Viljoen, saying he likes transaction capital because of We Buy Cars. And We Buy Cars was, as we now know, was the star of that show, that shit show, as Mr. Hurwitz discussed it, or David Hurwitz described it to us at some point. But he bought Transaction Capital, and it wouldn't surprise me if Pitt isn't invested in We Buy Cars. Walter Ayllett has invested heavily in We Buy Cars. He owns 5% of the his clients own 5% of the whole company, and they got in at 18.50, and we're now looking at 36 rand. Maybe there's a story like that here, Dave.
In Altron.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Through Netstar.
And look, We Buy Cars, I was cynical on it. I said, who wants to buy a Jewel Street car trade, secondhand car trader? But I think the more I spoke to people who used their service, the more impressed I was with how high tech they were and how good a service they gave. Yes, I've got a bit of egg on my face because I didn't understand the business. What Altron, if we think about Altron, what do we think of? Cables, engineering, electronics. We haven't adjusted our sights to what Werner has done and how he's upped those areas, as he said, the best kept secret. Because in our mind, Reunertz was the same thing. Have a look at the performance of Reunertz. Remember, they used to run neck and neck. Also a company that has turned itself around, repositioned itself, and doing very, very well. But I think Altron kind of caught us by surprise, and I'm glad that you've got this clip with Werner, because suddenly those businesses that we didn't put any kind of value on are doing well. Just one other point. If you look at Karoo and Netstock, Karoo still does most of its business here. You know, even though it's gone to Singapore and it's on the NASDAQ, its growth predominantly is still here. It's still this market. So I don't think they've shot the lights out, and I might be... Chris Logan's going to kill me, but I mean, I don't know if they've shot the lights out in Singapore or any old Franco Lorenzani, you know, who carry the flag for Karoo. I still think it's very much a local business.
It is indeed, and David Shapiro is still very much a local hero, the favorite stockbroker, South Africa's favorite stockbroker. Always good to be catching up with David. Well, we did mention a little earlier in the program the U.S. presidential race. There's a lot going on, and as you know, David he has got family there. He's been hoping that Harris would win, but kind of, I don't know if you could say resigned to the fact that Trump seems to be winning. But here's how the Financial Times explained how the U.S. election works and what we should be looking out for. There are partners in London.
There is a lot of uncertainty, and it's not just from the markets. What we do know is that just 7 battleground states are expected to determine the outcome. We don't know who will win or even when we might get the result. So here to explain what you should be looking out for is the FT's Washington Bureau Chief, James Politi. Hi, James.
Hi, Sonia. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. So when do you think we might know who won the election?
Well, I mean, in 2020, we didn't know who had actually won the election until the Saturday after the election, when Joe Biden's victory was called. In 2016, we found out on Wednesday morning, very early, that Donald Trump had defeated Hillary Clinton. And this is a very close election, so it could take, you know, a few days before we actually find out the winner.
And James, you know, it's striking to me that I feel like I used to always go to bed knowing who won the election, and that just doesn't seem like the norm anymore. Why is that?
I think there are two factors. One is that elections are extraordinarily close at the moment. They're fought in a few battleground states, decided by just a few thousand votes. So it takes a while for anyone to be able to declare the winner. And then the other very important factor is that there are rules in certain states, including Pennsylvania, that mean that ballots that have been cast before Election Day, so mail-in ballots in particular, can't be processed until Election Day. And so that takes some time.
Okay, so let's break it down by candidate then on what we should be looking out for. What could we see in early returns that would be a good sign for Trump?
Well, I think Trump will be looking, first of all, at his home state in Florida, which counts very fast and counts relatively early. In 2020, even though he lost the election to Biden, his sort of strong performance in Florida heralded a more difficult victory for Biden. And then there are other East Coast states in the South in particular. Virginia, North Carolina are two states where the polls close relatively early and will start counting, Georgia as well. And his performance in those three Atlantic southern states, I think, could be a very good bellwether for him.
And what about Harris? What early indicators would be good news for her?
I think she'll be watching the blue wall in particular, which is three states across the Mid-Atlantic and Great Lakes region, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, which she really has to win. And I think Pennsylvania in particular is a must-win state for Kamala Harris. She'll be looking at the turnout levels. She has to run up the numbers in the cities where she's expected to have greater support and the suburban areas surrounding the cities in order to neutralize the losses that she's expected to have in the rural counties.
Now, James, last...
Okay, well, we'll leave him there because just to build on that, essentially what James Politi, who's the White House correspondent for the Financial Times, or the Washington correspondent for the Financial Times, was saying, Harris has to win Pennsylvania and Trump has to win North Carolina and Georgia and Wisconsin. So I'm not going to go into the detail, the numerical details, but at the moment where we are is that North Carolina's in the bag. So Trump has won that one, so the experts tell us. Georgia, he's comfortably or is ahead in. Pennsylvania, which is the one that Harris has to win, Trump is ahead in. She's ahead in Michigan. And then there are two others, Arizona and Nevada, which have not yet given us any indication of how people have voted there. Trump's also ahead in Wisconsin. So it's a crazy kind of situation for us here in South Africa, where we look at this massive country of more than 300 million people, more than 50% of the investable assets in the world, only 5% of humanity, but 25% of global GDP. And there, they're going to decide on their leader because of the results and outcome in just a few states. Well, our favorite American is Peter Major. Peter Major is joining us now. I guess I can't really call you an American, Peter, because you're more South African than American. But I'm sure that you have a better grasp on all of this stuff than I know you have a better grasp on all of this stuff than we do. You were a little bit cautious about Trump winning because of the volatility that it would bring to the world, and as a consequence, the ability of your sector, mining, to make long-term decisions. If you've got a volatile fellow back in the White House, do you still feel the same way?
Look, very much, Alec, and it's not just me, it's some of the Chinese business people we deal with. And I've had the experience of having a good couple hours with a very connected Russian. He's not an oligarch, but he's a businessman. He graduated from Harvard. He got a degree, MBA at Stanford, worked for a Fortune 500 company in America. So he's very international. But the consensus is pretty much just what you said. Everything's unpredictable with Trump. Whereas with Harris and the Democrats, they always think you can reason, you can make a deal, you can kind of plot forward. But Trump looks like he's going to get it, and it's going to be four more years of whatever you think he got now, you might not have this afternoon. And that includes his own staff. You know, there were stories, one of his cabinet members decided he wanted to leave. And he says, I want to make it as easy as possible on you, Donald. You know, you can decide how, you can come up with every story you want. And Donald says, yeah, this is really serious. You know, you can't drop me. You really owe me on this. So the guy says, no, I want to do it correctly. He said they were walking down the stairs of the plane when they landed. Donald was already waving for the mic. He says, I got a real important announcement to make. And he'd already worked out the story. This guy was leaving. The guy was shocked. So that, to me, sums up. You don't know what's going to happen from the next hour, and that will keep the volatility up. And that's actually good for a lot of fund managers. Certainly good for me because it gives you opportunities. But it's hard to make long-term plans for sure. It's much harder for people in the country and outside to kind of plan things when you don't know if it's a solid base you're on and you don't know if it could change quickly.
What might be going through Neil Froneman's mind right now? We're going to talk more about Sibanye. They brought a trading update, share price up 10% on the JSE yesterday. Neil really has to be pretty focused on what goes on in the United States because he's got so much of Sibanye is now there. What do you think's going on in his head?
I don't know. Sometimes I wonder that even under a calm Democratic administration. Neil's juggling a lot of balls, and it's hard to say where his focus should be. He's pretty experienced. He's got a pretty good team. Those were a decent set of results, production results and financials that came out for the third quarter. I think they did surprise everybody, me included. But at the end of the day, he's got to look at his operations and look at the environment they're in. He's heavy into precious metals, but mainly platinum group metals. And they came down off a real high, and they're sitting at an okay price, which is their 20-year average in real terms, their 10-year average in real terms. So they're sitting right at the mean And I hate things sitting at the mean because you don't know which way they're going to go, Alec. So Neil's got to say, gee, do I put more money into the PGMs and gold? Geez, it's so high now. It's too late to start putting money into gold. He's done well getting money from the states and from the European Union. And anytime a mining company can get money from the government, I think they deserve all they can get. They pay hell of a lot of taxes. They support a lot of jobs, a lot of industry. And yet mining always seems to be at the back of the queue when government is handing out billions of rands of grants to friends and businesses who will never make it, or the states. They hand out billions and tens of billions of dollars for industries in trouble that they decided are imperative. So now we're seeing mining actually getting on the list and getting some money. And it's still tiny, tiny money. It's parking meter change compared to what governments are giving out before. But Neil's been able to get that. And that's a bit of a coup. And that is good. And I hope they get more, because mining does so much for all the countries that it's in. And all it gets is bad news, shakedown artists, you owe us, you owe us.
Looking at those numbers that came out yesterday, a major fillip for Sibanye came from South Africa, and particularly the old gold mines. How much longer have they got to go? We often talk about South African gold, and people of our age can remember when this country was the number one gold producer in the world, but it's just fallen all the way down the scale and is not quite irrelevant, but is a long, long way from where it was. How much juice is still in that lemon squeeze?
Very little, Alec, and we are almost irrelevant. We are less than 3% of world gold production now. You know, 3%. And we still can arguably claim we've got half the world's known gold. And what made us great was we focused on it, and we knew it was the word raison d'etat. You know, it was what made South Africa. Okay, diamonds did at the start, but they were volatile. And Oppenheimer wasn't the first to say gold is really where it's at. We've got so much gold in this country, and we've got the means to produce it economically at a profit. And gee, gold went flat for 40 years, 1933 to 1973, and all we did was increase production the whole time. We more than doubled the employment when the gold price was flat. We put everybody out of business. We were like the Chinese in mining. We just perfected, doing the same main business over and over. And it was cost control. We had fantastic cost control. We still had the best paying blue collar jobs. We had great career paths for everybody. And I mean, everybody, even during apartheid, had good career paths on the gold mines. Now we've thrown it away. And I see it on the chrome side. And yeah, we're still the world's biggest chrome producer, about 50%. But our costs are taking us over. So looking at the gold side, it really did well, mainly because of the gold price. But Sibanye didn't benefit very much. I think they got 3% increase in price, whereas the actual gold price was up about 10 or 11 because they've hedged a lot. But those mines are rickety. They're deep. And the costs just knocked me off my seat. Our costs are so high in South Africa because everybody's wanted their cut, especially the government, but the communities and the unions, the suppliers, and you've just had to give in because mining's always been the bad boy, certainly for the last 30 years here, and you've got everybody against you, institutions against you, so it's really limited. I think if this gold price came off a bit, the majority of Sibanye's gold mines would be closed within 2 years. If gold price stays here, he can probably get another 5 years. But they are deep, huge, overhead, old, old gold assets.
But you said earlier that South Africa's got 50% of the known gold reserves. Now, that seems as though like you're resources. Sitting on resources. You're sitting on a gold mine, but you're not actually exploiting it. What's the story there, Peter? Is it possible that we could have a change in attitude by the government of national unity and open up that potential treasure box?
we could never get back to where we were because most of our gold mines were very deep and they did take billions of capital. And the people that would risk that, like Oppenheimer and like Rand Mines and Gencore, those people are gone. And they were risking their own money. And the bankers, the foreigners that were backing those men, they're gone. So you can't find anybody that's going to back someone who wants to put money into a 10 to 14,000 feet deep gold mine that's going to take 8 to 10 years to get to production. I don't think you can find anybody on the planet that wants to go on that. And we don't have them here. And you have to lead by example. When Ernest Oppenheimer was putting every cent he owned into these mines, he was calling in every friend to put in every cent. When Cecil Rhodes was calling every friend he had and using his own money to put it in, that encourages people. You know, when leaders lead from the front and they're throwing everything they've got in, that encourages you. And then when they deliver on it, you're double encouraged. So we don't have leaders like that here, business leaders that will do that. It is risky. And the world doesn't like that kind of risk. And it doesn't like an industry where everybody's trying to get their 2 cents from it, whereas you've got thousands of pieces of legislation, a falling infrastructure. The environment is just so much different, Alec. Gold could probably go to $3,000, $5,000. Maybe you'd see a couple small, shallow mines, something that could supposedly bring production in 2 to 3 years. And we've got enough gold resources here. We could have a few mines like that. But we need a lot more to change, starting with the GNU government, starting with legislation, reduce the amount of legislation. I think the royalties need another look at. There's a plethora of work we have to do to create an environment that would attract money.
Yeah.
To do that.
Gwede Mantashe is not the most popular person in mining, and you can understand why. But interestingly enough, Cyril Ramaphosa has a history with Pan-African Resources, and I see yesterday we had news from Pan-African Resources that it's spending R1 billion buying an Australian gold mine. Now, doesn't that tell you something?
It does. It says Quibus wants to diversify his risk. He's good at gold mining. He's good at dump retreatment. But you don't want it all in one country. There's 210 countries on the planet, and you're pretty good at that particular commodity. But to have it all in one country, whereas this is still a very populist government. Populist means it says what the people want to hear, or they say what they think the people want to hear, just like we're seeing with the Trump campaign. Very populist in the States now, and that's what appeals to people. So do you want to put all your assets in a government here that they may say more radical things all the time just to try and get more votes, and you're going to be the Wally in the room? You know, you're going to be – you always need a demon when you're trying to rally the troops. And boy, gold mines have been the demon here for decades and decades, and they're too good to not use. So it looks like a great move what Quibus has done. It's a great property. It's in a good area. Looks like he paid a fair price, though. He didn't get it cheap. You know, when you're buying gold properties at the highest gold price man's ever seen, you're not going to get anything cheap. But it has a lot of upside as far as increase in production, and that's what he's got to do. He's got to get a lot more production and a lot more resources out of that area. You know, they like bragging all the kilometers of area that go with it that haven't been explored. Well, there just better be a lot more gold there. But it's prudent diversification.
Peter Major is the Director of Mining for Modern Corporate Solutions. As always, a privilege to have his wisdom and insight on our program. Well, we're going to be talking in just a moment with Wayne Duvenage, who is the Chief Executive of Outer, on two big issues. The electricity price increase proposed by Eskom, which Outer is opposing. They've put together a proposal to National Energy Regulator. We'll find out more about that. And water. Yesterday, we had a report coming out from Outer, which assessed what the new water minister has got to say about her first 100 days in office. Seemed quite good, excepting, does she address the major issues? But before we get there, My colleague Chris Stain yesterday interviewed Fadil Adams of the Police Portfolio Committee in Parliament. You just got to listen to this story and hope that something happens soon to the honest policeman who's been in jail for 4.5 years.
Of an interview you conducted with a former task team member who has been on remand in prison for almost 5 years. Tell us what that is all about, Mr. Adams.
The sad thing is that he's not the only one. But I will not mention his name for his safety. But I went to Westville because I was directed to this gentleman by another policeman who cares about the state of SAPS. And I went to Westville prison in my capacity as a member of parliament, and I asked to see a specific prisoner, and I wanted to see him alone. I said to the, let me first commend the staff at the Westville prison for doing a very professional job under very trying circumstances, especially the deputy commissioner of KZN. But I was put in touch with this man, and I spoke to him, and you know, I left Westville prison, he was still running down my face, because I had an in-depth meeting with a few people. But one story, I still can't get it out of my head. He says to me, Mr. Adams, I was called into the office of Brigadier Kamalo, and he wanted me to arrest a mayor. And I said to him, there's no evidence that justifies an arrest. And he says to me, General Kamalo says that minister at the time, Beki Tsele, does not care about the evidence. He wants the media narrative. Go and arrest this woman. And he said, I will do it. I'm not a politician. I'm a policeman. Weeks later, he was arrested for defeating the ends of justice. Now, let me explain something to you. I wasn't always a good boy. I've been to court maybe 50 times in my life. No case runs for longer than 12 or 13 months without the state bringing evidence before the judge kicks it out. No man lies on remand awaiting trial 4.5 years for a non-violent crime. I believe that this poor officer is a political pawn. And I believe that certain people that work for the justice system are part of this mafia. If you listen to this officer, and if you listen to the testimonies of the people that speak of him, they're saying that this man did nothing wrong. This man simply refused to obey an illegitimate instruction. He said, no, I'm not a politician. I am a policeman. Do not ask me to do this, General. Next thing you know, he's in jail for 4.5 years.
Fadil Adams is a member of parliament with the National Coloured Congress. And who says that you shouldn't have smaller parties in parliament who can actually get out there and make a noise and go and do the things that sometimes our big parties have been remiss in? Let us hope that this visit by Mr. Adams results in action, because it's appalling, isn't it? Wayne Duvenage has dealt with a lot of appalling things in his time. He is the chief executive of OUTA and a school friend of mine. Let's you know, full disclosure, Wayne, we're both from Newcastle High many, many years ago. You've been shaking up South Africa ever since you started or helped to start OUTA, the organization opposing tax abuse. You guys had a big day yesterday with two focus areas, and I'd love you to take us through both of them, starting off with the Eskom, or the proposed Eskom hike of 66% over the next 3 years, remembering that it's just got a hike of 3 times the inflation rate for the current year. Just give us at the nub of your argument appears to be they are calculating, or they're approaching this like a public sector organization. We'll charge what we want. We won't be efficient. We charge what we pay what we want with our costs, and then we'll get the money in from the public rather than becoming more efficient.
Yeah, and that's the nub of our submission, and it has been for some time, Alec. You know, right from the multi-year price determination model that they put in place a number of years ago, NYPD-1, we're now on NYPD-6. And I think, if you go back to about 2007, 2008, when it all really started getting out of hand is with the Medupi and the Kusile tenders that had gone out and they were going ahead with these constructions. And we could see that they were losing control, and we were making submissions to NERSA to say, your role as the regulator is to start putting pressure on Eskom to get its costs in order, because, you know, those power stations were budgeted at around 70 billion rand each, and they, I think they've run three times that. Headcounts grew by 50% from 32,000 to just under 50,000 staff. Yet there were no additional electrons being put into the grid over that time, as people started to feel the rising costs and the economy was under constraints. So, yeah, we think, you know, NERSA has really dropped the ball over that decade of from about 2007 to 2018, and it just lives on now. And we just see this constant request for more money. Eskom's in a death spiral. So we are saying, you know, you've got to control your primary energy costs. You've got to bring them down. You know, you've gone from a tied corollary, the mines that were tied to the power stations. You've moved away from that. Sadly, that was Brian Molefe's biggest mistake, where he said he didn't want to own the bakery. He just wanted to buy the bread. Well, if you do buy all the bread from the bakery, best you own the bakery every time, because now we find ourselves as Eskom, you know, locked into these massive contracts. But they've got to work their way out of them. They've got to get their head costs and manpower costs down, and right, their productivity has to go up. And of course, they're battling with some maintenance costs, which were neglected for so long. So that's gone up, and they're getting some of that under control. But what you have now, Alec, is 6,000 megawatts gone off grid, with literally Eskom forcing the public to privatize and do their own energy, find their own energy solutions. And that's coming back to haunt them. They aren't going to be able to sell more electrons. They've got these massive costs still. They're not controlling them. And so they turn to NERSA and say, well, we have to cover our costs, so we want these massive increases. It just is on a downward spiral. It's a death spiral right now. And the poorest of the poor, and those who cannot afford to find their own solutions, are going to suffer the most. And something has to change. And that's why we have put our submission in again to say, you know, you really have to get Eskom, which you should have been doing for a long time now, to become serious about focusing on the reduction of their costs.
As a taxpayer, what kind of sticks in the craw most is that the Treasury has given Eskom 500 billion rand to pay off debts, taxpayers' money. So it's our taxes that are there, which have, in fact, the Treasury's had to borrow the money to give to Eskom to pay off debts. But we're not seeing this reflected in the cost increases that Eskom wants. If there had been no recovery from the Treasury, if Treasury had not given this bailout to Eskom, would Eskom have been able to survive as we sit right now, quite apart from sitting there and demanding a 36% electricity increase this year? I think that's kind of the thing that confuses many.
Yeah, look, they wouldn't be able to survive. They wouldn't be able to pay their suppliers, their salaries. So the government was in a difficult situation. They had no choice but to start settling or covering some of these massive debts that Eskom had got into over the years. And I think we also, you know, got to ask how and why did they get into these massive increased debts? And that was because government was backing those bonds back then. And they showed this massive suddenly revaluation of all their assets, which made it look good. The balance sheet looked good, and they were giving good returns on those bonds. And the lending public said, well, how much do you want? And gave them what they needed. Now, if government's going to back those guarantees, which they shouldn't have, and should have put Eskom under pressure to control its costs then, then they're going to have to do it exactly what they've done. They're going to have to bail the Eskom out to that extent. So this is a classic case of poor management, poor leadership, poor understanding of the complexities of running, you know, massive organizations like this, putting people into positions of power or leadership that were unfit for to run those organizations for far too long, taking the eye off the ball of maintenance, and the system comes down. And now we, the taxpayer, and remember, government doesn't bail anyone out. We do, just under their instructions, have got to just live with this. And we're going to live with it for a long time. And I don't know how we're going to correct the Eskom situation, because these, I think Eskom in the long run, if you look forward a decade, 2 decades from now, as it mothballs its old assets, coal-fired power stations, it really is just going to be buying energy from the private sector, something it resisted for so long, but now has no choice. Because green energy and other efficient energy suppliers are going to provide this electricity far cheaper than Eskom ever could.
And you're going to be sitting with a lot of people, many of them cadres deployed there, who are going to be drawing salaries for the position they've put us in. But let's move across to water now, Wayne. You guys have also been focusing on that for some time, warning us that that's the next big problem. And we did have the Minister of Water Affairs, the new Minister of Water Affairs, Pemi Mojadina, telling us that she would be, giving us her 100-day feedback. From the statement that you guys put out, you say, well, that's cool. You know where the problems are, but they're not getting much better. Just unpack for us.
Yeah, Alec, we started WaterCAN, that's Water Community Action Network, a couple of years ago because I think Dr. Farrell Adams, who's been with us for some time, is a specialist in this space. And we've decided to also look at providing solutions and unpacking how do we fix this issue, because it has been looming for some time. And so our citizen science approach is to get, if we can't rely on government to do the green drop and blue drop reports and get a good picture of what the quality of our water situation is, then let's get the people to do that. Let's get citizens active. And we provide these test kits across the country and we start to measure. So that was the nub of the exercise. It continues to grow. We're developing and upgrading the water heat map now. And we've been following what has been happening. And the concerns are that you've got this disparity between local government, where it controls the wastewater treatment plants, the reservoirs, the management of water, and national government trying to do all its best to protect the country from a disaster and dealing with the Lesotho Highlands Water Project, which Nomvula Mokonyane sat on her hands for 5 years and did nothing and set us back for so long. Dam construction and making sure that we've got the reserves that we need to supply a very thirsty country, and yet we don't have the reserves. So we are, as a country, not conscious of water saving, first of all, as consumers, and as municipalities, we are not conscious of maintaining water infrastructure and being efficient about it. And so we are losing so much in leaks. And it's sad that you sit in a city like Johannesburg and the cities in Gauteng that have this massive problem. And again, it goes to the same Eskom problem and so much else that we do wrong in government. And that is we think that if we can't see the leaks, they're underground. If we can't see what poor maintenance does over time and it catches up with you, and that's really where we are. So if we're not going to maintain our infrastructure, the leaks get worse and worse, the roads get worse and worse, the potholes get worse, and then you say, oops, gee, we've got a problem. Well, we've been saying this for some time. We have a serious problem on all fronts, but in the water space, we have got a dire situation. Our national government, and Chunu was very good. We like the fact that he's gone to the police because it's a big problem to sort out there. He is a type of minister that can get down to business. And the new minister is realizing that she's got to take this baton. And we think that she has to set up new sort of almost special purpose vehicles to manage wastewater treatment plants, because municipalities just don't give a damn, quite frankly. Raw sewage pumping into our rivers is not a problem for them. They'd rather spend the Mogale City money on building a new civic center than fix the wastewater treatment plant, which is causing chaos through the cradle of humankind, a World Heritage Site, which will lose its listing if we're not careful, and ruins people's lives downstream. So at a national level, the minister realizes that there's a lot of work, and now national government has to find a way to usurp the powers, which the laws don't allow them to, usurping the executive powers of local government. And if we don't find this solution and quickly, local government's just going to say, we don't have the money to fix the leaks, to fix the wastewater treatment plants. And national government say, well, we're going to try and get the funds and help you, and international funding might have to come in, but we need to take control of it. We cannot leave the control in the hands of municipalities. That's our biggest challenge right now.
Wayne Duvenage is the chief executive of OUTA, the organization that attacks tax abuse. And I strongly recommend that you support them in any way that you can. They take donations of $100 a month. Some of the information that comes out of OUTA is quite sensational. I've got some in yesterday's report. They spoke about some of my old stamping grounds in the south of Johannesburg, South Hills and Lynnmeyer, who haven't had water for 10 days, and that the reservoir has been dry for over a year. There's lots needed to fix South Africa. We can do it, thanks to people like OUTA. I'm Alec Hogg from our team of technical producer Ruan Erasmus, executive producer Lucy Ferreira, and yours truly, until tomorrow at 7. Cheerio.